This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, the military says that American troops will remain in Iraq for years, and China cancels rapper Jay-Z's plans for a concert there. Guess they don't like the lyrics to 99 Problems. Joining us today from our NPR headquarters in Washington is Joe Davidson, an editor at The Washington Post. Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, is at member station WCPN in Cleveland, Ohio. And we've also got Callie Crossley, social cultural commentator on the television show Beat the Press in Boston. Thank you all for being with us. And let me move straight ahead to the latest news from the Pentagon. The Army indicated it could keep at least 140,000 soldiers in Iraq through the year 2010. It doesn't say that they will. It just says that they want to be prepared. Callie, how do we read this latest news?
Bad news, and more bad news. And we now have an intransigent administration, the Bush administration, not listening to his own experts, is the way I read it. It's very clear that if you're going to keep troops there until 2010, or even if you're going to project that you may need to, that this thing is not coming to an end. And yet, report after report says that there seems to be not only no light at the end of the tunnel, but the situation has devolved into something much worse than anybody could ever have anticipated. So now we have, in effect, a civil war, and we have an Iraqi parliament talking about possibly dividing the country into sections, which was exactly what this was supposed to be about. We were supposed to come in, deliver freedom, victory, and old-style democracy so that there would be a central government and everybody would all get along. But that is not what is happening. And furthermore, now we have the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Peter Pace, saying that he's not certain that when the Iraqi troops could take over. So what does that mean? More American troops staying there for longer. To what end, I do not know. And the question I have to continue to ask is, what is it all for?
Professor Berry, yesterday on our letter segment, we got a letter from someone who just came back from Fallujah. I believe he was a Marine. And he was saying that he doesn't think that everything is as gloom and doom as, you know, the diplomacy is probably better, and that, you know, he felt the show was a little bit too negative. On the other hand, I've talked to some other troops who are active and currently in Iraq, and they are completely dismayed and demoralized. What do we as Americans who are not over there fighting need to know about what's going on with these troops?
Well, I think it depends on where the troops are and who you're talking to. And first, I have to say that I bet my house on this show that we would pull out some troops before the election. And I hope people have forgotten that I bet my house, because I don't want to lose my house. But anyway,
you can just give it to me.
the politics shifted. It depends on you talk. If you're talking to the folks who just got back, who were wounded and are now in the hospital, as I do, they tell you distressing stories about the conditions where they were. If you talk to my cousin who was over there, and who is back, thank God, you will hear distressing stories about the fighting and the fear and not knowing what's going to blow up or happen next, and how the people are all upset, the Iraqi people, at all of their folks who've been killed and all the conditions that are over there, and how it's just really distressing to try to think about what the troops are supposed to be doing. And if you talk to some troops who are in a place where it's relatively quiet, they might think that, oh, well, you know, it looks great. It's like in Vietnam, though, when we used to think, when I was a reporter, that somebody who was innocent, some child or some young person you were trying to help, and then you'd walk away and say, look, this place is peaceful, and then the whole thing would blow up right behind your back, and you would just barely get away. It's bad. It's bad. It's bad. And, of course, Donald Rumsfeld tried to clean up by saying that this general doesn't make plans for what happens. But Mr. Bush has said he will take advice from his general. And his general has no reason to make projections just to be trying to disturb people. What he's trying to do is plan. And we know that the Army officers are very concerned about their troops being overstretched and worn out.
Joe, you're in Washington, you know, at the Washington Post, and in the nestled in the bosom of the Beltway, if I can put it that way. What are people on both sides of the aisle saying about what they want to do, legislators, about Iraq?
Well, first let me let Mary know that we have a guest room, because she probably will lose her house, it seems. I think that there is a growing mood here in Washington. a growing pessimistic mood, if you will, among those on the Hill. Certainly Democrats for a while have been talking about the need to begin at least thinking about or developing a plan to pull the troops out of Iraq, even if they have not articulated a set plan. But then you had John Warner, you know, the senator from Virginia, who came back from a trip to Iraq, saying that he would give it 2 or 3 months, and if things don't improve, there needs to be a reassessment of the situation. And you even have George Bush, who just said the other day, quote, if the plan is now not working, the plan that's in place isn't working, America needs to adjust. He said that in agreement with John Warner. So I think that we're beginning to see a shift away from, even among Republicans, I should say, from the total stay the course attitude to an acknowledgement that if the plan doesn't work in the future, or if the plan doesn't continue to work, as they would put it, then maybe the United States needs to make some adjustment.
But, you know, Farai, if I may just put this in, I think the real question, Joe, is where do we go from here? Once we all conclude, and the Republicans are gradually concluding this, that it's not working, you know, what do we do to either make a graceful exit, or what do we do to try to stay there anyway? Or I think that's what the next issue is.
I'll
just throw out something. I had a conversation with a military expert who spoke to me on background, and I said, well, what if there were more troops and people rebuilt the country and then we left? And he's like, we don't have enough troops to do that. It was a really sobering assessment that basically, in his opinion, and he was a high-ranking Army official, that that we just don't have enough troops to really secure the country.
Well, you know, one interesting point on that, I think, is that we're looking at this from the point of view of the United States, and obviously that's understandable. But there was a poll conducted by the State Department and another poll conducted by researchers from the University of Maryland. Both of those polls indicated that the vast majority of people in Baghdad and then throughout the throughout Iraq want the coalition forces to leave. And so the rebuilding aspect, I think, is something that ultimately, clearly, and everybody knows this, is going to fall on the hands of the Iraqis. I think the question is, can that rebuilding be done with the coalition forces there if those coalition forces, in fact, draw violence, which is the concern of many military people, including the chief of staff in Britain, who is now calling for British troops to at least consider withdrawing over periods of time. So the real question is, as this British general raised, are the troops there contributing to the problem more than solving the problem?
And in the middle of all of that, it's a civil war. So, I mean, for all of the best intentions of the coalition forces on the parts that they're trying to rebuild, folks are fighting, you know. So even when they are not the target, the other folks are the target. And so you can't get anything done in the midst of a civil war.
Yeah, well, in terms of responsibility, Farai, before you move on, in terms of responsibility, even Americans who didn't support going to war in Iraq in the first place and who were suspicious and who now been proven right, we are all collectively responsible because we are Americans, and it was the President of the United States who decided we were going to do this, and now we've gone over there, and now there is a big mess, and now 600,000 people, according to the Johns Hopkins study, and I believe them more than I do people who are not statisticians, have been hurt, killed, or whatever in Iraq as a result, and there's a mess. So the question is, we helped to create a mess where we had good intentions. So now what do we do? Do we just leave people there? And if we can't fix it and we can't make it any better, do we leave because we can't make it any better? It really is a difficult question to answer.
And you know that we'll keep talking about it. Next topic is about Islam, not about overseas, but right here. Some Muslim cab drivers in Minneapolis are saying that they won't pick up passengers who've been drinking alcohol. Now, of course, it's not just drinking alcohol, it's also people who are carrying duty-free bags full of alcohol. And half of the drivers at the airport in that city are Somali Muslims, so African Muslims. Now, people have debated various solutions, but a lot of folks, the main public opinion seems to be saying this is discrimination against passengers. The cab drivers are saying if you don't allow us to make certain choices, it's discrimination against the drivers. Joe, what do we make of this?
Well, you know, I think that this is one of the difficulties that comes along with the benefits of a multicultural society. I guess if you were in Saudi Arabia, this would not be an issue. In the United States, however, I think that the cabbies I think you could argue that they've put themselves in a difficult position because they want the fares, they want the business, they want to pick up passengers and carry them where they go, but then they don't want to pick up certain passengers. And for Americans, that's just discrimination, and you cannot deny service to people who are not doing anything illegal, who don't present a threat to you as a cabbie. And so I think that the cabbies will have a very tough time, you know, making any headway with that argument, with the argument that they're being discriminated against on religious grounds if they have to carry people who are carrying alcohol that's closed in a bag, and not necessarily a person is drunk. I think they're going to have a very difficult time with that argument.
Well, Callie, a couple things. First of all, ferrying drunk passengers has become one of the things that taxis do, you know, with all of the drunk driving safety issues. But secondly, what really intrigued me is that the Airport Commission was trying to have a system where cabs who wouldn't take passengers with alcohol would have certain lights, and the public opinion basically said, no, that's not going to happen. If someone's not going to take a passenger, they have to go to the back of the line and wait another 3 hours. What do you think about those issues?
I have to say, I think that's right. I thought the majority of the issue was really about people coming in with purchases from either wine country or from duty-free shops in which they clearly had bags carrying alcohol, which to me is even more problematic than people who are drunk. I maybe could see why you might not want to take a drunk passenger, however, that's been our safety net for drunks to get them off the road and not be driving and affect other people. I really feel strongly that this is a profession that they chose. They knew that part of the passengers they're going to have to pick up are going to somehow not follow the same religious rules that they follow, and this is a problem. So one of the ways that the commission has dealt with it is making them go to the back of the line. I personally agree with that. Now, if it were a scenario in which they said, listen, you know, there's a majority of us here, we want to be off for a religious holiday, I could go with you on that. But on this one, they, you know, nobody's forcing them to drink the alcohol.
Let me go to Professor Barry.
Behind these pharmacists who are not, you know, around the country now saying because of religious reasons they will not fulfill birth control pills. It's the same kind of situation. Where does this line stop? I mean, I am for supporting people and their religious beliefs. I really am. But at a certain point, this was a scenario in which they clearly understood what the work was in getting into it. And I don't think that this is the correct protest. And by the way, not all Muslims agree with the group of Muslims who are saying
that's a point well taken. Let me go to you, Professor Barry, because I want to toss in one more topic after this.
Farai, I just think that I agree with everything that they've said, but I also had it called to my attention, something I had noticed, that the people who are driving cabs who have the concession at the Minneapolis airport seem to be mostly Somali Muslims. There is no way in the world that a taxi cab company can have a monopoly at an airport. And there are other airports, this issue is a separate issue, it's been raised, where people of particular groups get the monopoly on the stranglehold on the jobs there. Not only do they have the jobs, they're now going to tell other people what to do and who they will serve and what they must have with them, even when it's legal. I just think that it's outrageous. I believe in free exercise of religion, but this is just absolutely ridiculous in my opinion. And I think another whole topic is who has the concessions at airports. We have that problem at Dulles Airport in Washington, D.C., about which group of people has the concession and who passes it along.
Don't get me started on D.C.
taxi cabs. Get concentrated.
All right. One more bonus round question or topic. China's culture ministry canceled a Jay-Z concert this month. They want to protect local hip-hop fans from his nasty lyrics. Let's hear a little clip.
If you having girl problems, I feel bad for you, son. I got 99 problems, but a bitch ain't one. I got the rap patrol on the cat patrol. Foes that want to make sure my cask is closed. Rap critics to say he's money cash holes. I'm from the hood, stupid. What type of facts are those?
And I think most of us know what was bleeped. A B ain't one. On the other hand, Jay-Z is highly sought after and much loved in Nigeria, where his ticket prices are $200, $600 if you want VIP seats. Very, very quickly, I'm going to go through everybody. Joe, is it positive that America is spreading, you know, mainstream hip hop, or are we spreading stereotypes?
Well, my first reaction when I read this story was that there are a lot of parents who would probably like to have just China's power. I think that a lot of hip hop is positive. I think a lot of hip hop is good music. I don't like the lyrics that we just played and some of the other lyrics from hip hop. I don't think though that we should just cast all of hip hop into one kind of profane category, because I don't think that's the case. And so, to answer your question, it's hard to answer it in that general way, because I think in some cases it could be good. Other cases with the profane lyrics, the violence-prone lyrics, the lyrics that fall in that category, I don't think that's a good American export.
Professor Barry and Callie, you're going to have to go quick.
I think that having this kind of concert in Nigeria, with all of the problems in that country and the poverty and the few little people benefiting from the oil money and the chaos, is just like having a hip-hop concert with sexually explicit lyrics in the middle of flood victims trying to save their lives after Katrina. And I just think it's outrageous. I'm in favor of hip-hop, but not that kind of hip-hop being spread around the world, and for Nigeria to seize on it and think this is great. Oh, we're going to have a good time. And not worry about the other people in the country. Just crazy.
Callie?
I am sorry that folks like Jay-Z, who are just fabulous as a mogul and a business person, don't see the larger issue around media and the power that he has. I'm not trying to tell him to self-censor, but to just put something positive out there in a general sense so that China and everybody else could embrace it. I wish that people would understand the power of media and how to use it in that way.
All right, thanks. We've been talking to Callie Crossley of Beat the Press in Boston, Mary Frances Berry of the University of Pennsylvania, and Joe Davidson of The Washington Post. Thank you all so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.